Excuse me, recording has started.
Thank you, Anne. Well, welcome everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all. And welcome to the review of all rights protection mechanisms in all GTLD's PDP working group call on the 10th of October, 2018. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. We have quite a few participants online today. Attendance will be taken via the Adobe Connect room. So if you happen to be only on the audio bridge today, would you please let yourself be known now? All right, thank you. As a reminder to everyone, if you would please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll hand the meeting over to Kathy Kleiman. Please begin.
Hello, everybody. This is Kathy Kleiman. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I note that my two co-chairs are not on the call today, as Brian Beckham and Phil Coolen are both in Geneva. And I'm just double-checking to see if perchance they did come in. They're both in Geneva at a WIPO domain name panelist session that was taking place yesterday. So Phil's probably on his way back by now. So they did ask me to chair this call, which it is my pleasure to do. I wanted to remind you that today, that this week we have two meetings, both at kind of the usual time, this time 1 p.m. Eastern, today and Friday. I believe they are both scheduled to be two-hour meetings. However, it may not take that long on Friday. So this is an exciting week as we begin our countdown to Barcelona and the meeting, which I hope you will be attending, if not in person, then remotely. Remote participation has gotten so much better in recent years. So I hope you'll be coming in one way or the other. And actually, let me pause for statements of interest. Does anybody have anything to update for us regarding statements of interest? Okay, then we move on to yet another marathon session of individual proposals, which I want to show that we as the co-chairs deeply appreciate because we know they take considerable time and effort to prepare and to present. So we thank everyone who submitted individual proposals, and we note that now some of them are being revised and coming back, and we may be able to get to some of these revised and consolidated proposals. In some cases, two people are consolidating proposals on Friday and also at our first meeting in Barcelona. A preview of coming attractions at the start of our meeting next week, on Friday, we'll be talking in detail about the Barcelona meeting and how we'll be using the four sessions and which ones will be analysis group and which ones will be individual proposals and initial report. But I've been asked not to do that today because we have so many proposals going forward. Let me just remind you of the rules of the game, which is that the proponent of a proposal will be accorded 5 minutes, and the five-minute clock is already up, to present proposal rationale and supporting evidence. The floor will then be open to other working group members to comment on the proposal for a maximum of 2 minutes each, with a total discussion limited to 20 minutes, if we indeed even have to go that far. And at the end of 20 minutes, the proponent will have up to 4 minutes to respond, and traditionally we've been holding questions until the end. So people who ask questions during their 2 minutes, the proponent will respond at the end. And that's the way we do it. George Kirkios, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, George, has a number of proposals on the table, as well as Maria Petullo, whose proposal will be presented by staff because she was not able to make it and join us. And we tried really hard to find a time where she could. So George, proposal number 5 is on the floor. Would you like to take us through it?
Thanks, Kathy. George Kirkos for the transcript. Yeah, I just want to preface my remarks by saying that some of the more controversial proposals from both sides probably are not going to be able to reach consensus on their own. But folks might want to keep in mind that when we ultimately try to reach consensus, some proposals might be bundled and packaged together. So proposal A and B might not be able to reach consensus on their own, but A plus B together might be able to reach consensus. So if your natural inclination might be to oppose a proposal, try to keep an open mind and allow these proposals to go forward to public comments, because keeping them alive means that some of the proposals that you might personally favor could be bundled with an offsetting proposal to get what you want and have a little give and take. So anyways, proposal number 5, if it could be put into the pod, that might be helpful to people who are only on Adobe. The 3-word summary of this is the statute of limitations proposal. So the URS and UDRP, well, we're only limited to the URS right now, but the URS policy should be amended to introduce a limitation period for filing complaints. The IRT could decide the exact length, but for the purpose of the proposal, I propose that the limitation period be 2 years as measured from the creation date of the domain name. And the rationale of this proposal is that thinking if the URS didn't exist, disputes would be governed by the national laws of a jurisdiction, and most jurisdictions have a statute of limitations period limiting the period in which a dispute can be filed. And so you can get into an absurd scenario where a URS complaint can be brought, but because there's no limitation period currently, but the underlying court would not allow that dispute to be brought, which would mean that you have greater rights in the URS than you do under the national laws that are supposed to be really deciding what the expected outcome of the dispute can be. So this proposal attempts to eliminate that absurdity, and trademark owners who sleep on their rights by not bringing complaints in a timely manner should lose the ability to use the ADR procedures. And so these procedures exist to provide a faster and cheaper route to that expected outcome that would occur in a court of law, but not to provide a better outcome, i.e. greater rights for trademark holders. So implementation of a limitation period would be consistent with the reality that ICANN is not the place to create new law, but merely a venue that should respect and reflect existing laws in a conservative manner using globally recognized principles. So absence of such a limitation period in the current policies must be corrected to be consistent with underlying national laws. And so these policies were designed to remedy clearly abusive domain name registrations. But over time, the policies have morphed, and they tend to be exploited for situations that are no longer obvious, cyber squatting. And this is particularly the case for older domains, where the rate of false positives or controversial disputes more suited to the courts tend to be higher. So by refocusing the policy only on relatively newly created domains, which are the vast majority of simple disputes, that makes the policy basically more focused and more tailored to where the vast majority of cyber squatting exists. Most cyber squatting is on, you know, throwaway worthless domains, not on domains that have been renewed for 15, 20 years. And if you think about it, the trademark system in the United States, once a trademark application is published, opposers only have a 30-day time limit to oppose those applications. And those can be extended for up to 90 more days. So these limitation periods exist throughout the law and even in the trademark system themselves. So, and that's measured from the publication date of the trademark applications, or once they're accepted by the staff at USPTO, but not fully registered yet. And so, obviously, other countries have specific time periods. 2 years is the time period for Ontario, Canada, which is my jurisdiction. And trademark holders themselves are benefiting from limitation periods because if somebody wants to challenge a trademark holder after 5 years, their trademarks are incontestable. And so domain name holders, as holders of intellectual property themselves, deserve equal protection under the policy. And so the false positive rate would go down because most of those involve really valuable domains that have been registered for a long time, and so those would no longer be handled by the URS. Thank you.
George, thank you for that proposal. This is Kathy, of course. So now we open up the floor for those who want to speak in favor, to raise concerns, as well as to raise questions. Anybody who would like to speak about this limitation period proposal? John, go ahead, please.
John McElwain for the record. So, interesting proposal, George. There are a few things that you stated that are just not correct under U.S. law, but, you know, maybe it does bear looking into other jurisdictions as well. So, one of the things is that there is no statute of limitations for bringing a Lanham Act claim. There's simply no statute of limitations in that. And actually, what there is a doctrine of latches, which is what's currently applied at least in the UDRP. And as Greg Shatton pointed out in the chat, the URS is so new, there would be no statute of limitations issues going on with respect to that. The other thing is that the publication periods in perfect analogy in that even if you don't oppose an application, you still can cancel it after registration for any time for up to 5 years. And lastly, statute of limitations, again, at least in the United States, works on a standard of knew or should have known. What I think you're suggesting is more like a statute of ultimate repose, which is just an absolute bar at a particular time. And that's more, at least again in the United States, that's more like 10 years, 20 years, not 2 or 3 years. So I think, you know, just to conclude, we do need to be careful in making proposals and making statements that it's founded in the law without making sure that we've completely, you know, sort of discussed that and verified it to be true. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, John. Greg, go ahead, please. 2 minutes.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. First, just to add a couple of things to what John said. Cancellation proceedings, in addition, can go on at any time after the five-year period, you know, potentially hundreds of years, if incontestability is not claimed by the trademark owner, and even if incontestability is claimed, there are remaining grounds for cancellation, just fewer of them, that can be used at any time during the life of the mark. So there's no absolute bar at any time to seeking to cancel a U.S. trademark registration. Second part is really a question, which is how does this proposal deal with issues of a continuing harm or with changes in fact or circumstance? And since we're really, in case, talking more about latches than really statute of limitations, how does it deal with the issue of, as John put it, know or should have known? As opposed to just, you know, something that comes from the point of registration, which, you know, is from the point of view of the complainant, not really relevant. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Michael, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks very much, Michael Karaniklis, for the record. Yeah, I think this proposal is worth getting public comment on. People have mentioned that the URS is only for relatively new domains, but, you know, I think it's obviously that's going to change over time. And as there's been other proposals to expand the URS to legacy TLDs, you know, if those kinds of discussions are on the table, I think it's very important to consider aspects that are going to be problematic. So I think that it's very relevant to consider. To open up for public comment the idea of limitations. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Michael. We're certainly moving a number of issues forward to public comment from these individual proposals. Zach, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Zach Muskovich for the record. First of all, thank you, George, for making the proposal. I want to let the working group know that all of George's proposals are going to receive support from me to be put into the interim report for discussion. I think they've met that very low burden, but that applies to all of the proposals that we've heard from so far and that which we will hear from. Regarding this issue, we've heard some thoughtful comments so far, both pro and against this particular proposal, and that to me is an indication in and of itself that further study is required, further feedback is required, and that's something that I'd like to do as well. Particularly because if we even look at the WIPO consensus view on UDRP, it says panels have recognized that the doctrine of or defense of latches as such does not generally apply under the UDRP. And so latches has gotten very weak and sporadic support amongst some panelists, most panelists, in fact, in the UDRP. And where does that leave us with the URS? Well, as Greg pointed out, you know, the URS domains are new, but as Michael pointed out, we're drafting a policy that could be in place for another 20 years. And so at some point, some consideration should be given to where we draw the line to say, listen, we have a really simple and effective procedure set out for trademark owners to take down websites and suspend them when there's a clear and convincing evidence of cyber squatting. But that's the kind of simple and useful tool that you should avail yourself of immediately and not wait 25 years to bring it on 14 days notice to a respondent. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach, and thank you all commenters. I don't see any further
comments.
Kathy,
can I go with you? It's Claudia. I'm sorry, I'm on audio only.
Oh, Claudia, go ahead, please. You have 2 minutes.
Yeah, sure. Just to pick up on a couple of points that John, Greg, and I think Zach made. And also, thank you, George, for putting this forward. So my initial comment is just if we're going to be citing references to national law, I don't think the working group has undertaken an effort to survey national laws, and that might be something worthwhile for us to do. I'm just a little concerned if language like that goes into the proposal, which may not be accurate. So that's just my initial point. Second point is concerning the basis of the proposal, which is restricting a case being brought after 2 years. You need use, bad faith use, in these cases. And so I think, if I understand this correctly, this would essentially create an exception that would really kind of blow a hole through the entire policy, because a registrant could register a domain, wait 2 years, and then engage in bad faith use, because their trademark owner is going to need evidence of bad faith use. And so if you base this strictly on the registration date, then, again, you could have a scenario where the registrant merely waits 2 years, engages in bad faith use, and the trademark owner would be barred from bringing an action. And I'm trying to think. I thought I had a third point. I'll just stick with those two for now, Kathy. Thanks.
Thank you, Claudio, and thanks for telling me you were on audio. Nat Cohen, go ahead, please.
Oh, this is Rebecca. I'm also on audio, so I could get online.
Okay. After Nat, if that's okay. Great. So Nat, then Rebecca, and then probably back to George. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm following up on Claudio's point about use. That's a concern of mine as well, as I understand that, I see that as a good point, and that most of these statutes start when there's when the infringing use starts. I think that's a point well taken. I also see the latches issue of somebody using it in a consistent way for many years, and then many years later facing a URS. So I feel like my view is that there's merit to the underlying notion that George is raising, if not necessarily all the specifics, and so therefore worthy for further review and discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rebecca, please.
Hi, Rebecca Tashnet. So I think this is something that really needs to be put on the table for discussion, especially if we continue with the idea of possibly expanding this into consensus policies. So, you know, for legacy people who already have domain names to expose them to, you know, unlimited potential challenge going forward seems to me to be a very bad idea, and that would trip up any expansion into consensus policy, which I'm actually somewhat inclined to support if we can deal with people who have already acquired rights within the system. I also think it's worth noting that there are plenty of provisions, even in trademark law, that do start the clock ticking, not on a know or should have known basis, but simply to make the procedure work. So, for example, with registrations in the U.S. after 5 years, incontestability of various sorts kicks in, whether you knew or not, certain defenses or certain grounds of invalidity are cut off. There are a couple of European countries that have similar, slightly different provisions, but it's actually worth thinking about situations where we might cut off the cheapest, easiest, no-fuss method based on the thought that people are likely to have developed rights while still leaving them with more complicated remedies. Just as, you know, after a registration issues, things change if you try and cancel it then versus if you try and oppose it earlier. And that's just a matter of the clock ticking, not a newer and should have known standard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. So this is Kathy. I'm going to draw a line under Michael Graham. Nat Cohen, I'm assuming that's an old hand, but if it's not, let me know. I'm going to draw a line under Michael Graham because we're at our, and staff can correct me if I'm wrong, I think we're at our 20 minutes for discussion of this. Michael, go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. Michael Graham for the record. Just a couple of quick things. Obviously, this is ripe for discussion. One of my concerns with putting a statute of limitations on this is that in a number of these cases, they are brought URS against a number of registrations, some of which come at different times in the process. And so the egregious activity might include those registrations of domain names that occurred before, outside of the statute of limitations, but those should still be included. And then just a clarification from what I believe Zach was saying. No, the proposal is 2 years from the creation of the domain name, so that if your understanding is that it would be 2 years from the creation of the domain name or from the establishment of a website, whichever came later, that would be a change in the proposed terms. I just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Michael, thank you, and thank you, everyone, for a very thoughtful discussion on numerous points. It is back to you, Steph. I think it's a four-minute clock, right? George, it's back to you for wrap-up.
Yeah, first, Chris, for the transcript. Yeah, like Kathy, I want to thank everybody for the very thoughtful comments. This is just an initial proposal, and I welcome all the feedback that from members and from the public comment period, which I hope this will go to. Just to address some of the individual points that were made, one of the reasons why I didn't make a latches proposal was that it's somewhat more complicated to prove, whereas a hard time limit is a lot simpler administratively because this procedure doesn't have discovery, doesn't have cross-examinations, doesn't have the due process that would allow one to make good arguments for latches and more complicated agreements. Arguments, and so this is trying to keep it simple. So while the two-year time period might not be agreeable to everybody, one could obviously change that to perhaps make the policy more agreeable to all. I think it keeps it a lot simpler by doing it that way. As for the idea about surveying national law, which Claudio brought up, I 100% agree that would be very useful in the next stage after we receive public comments if this is something that people want to move forward on. There was the suggestion made that somebody might have a submarine registration where they just leave it inactive for a couple of years, and then once the time period elapsed, they would suddenly activate it and go mental and engage lots of cyber squatting and abuse. True, that's a theoretical possibility, but in the interim, they also have to be paying all the renewal costs, so there's a real cost to doing that. And furthermore, a lot of the domains don't actually have to be used. They could be so clearly abusive that they have no potential good faith use. And so the passive holding of a domain like google-login-2018- horse or whatever is clearly abusive. And even if it's not being used for anything, I'm pretty sure a panel would order it, suspend it, or transfer it for the UDRP. And so that's not necessarily a high hurdle. And we have to also keep in mind that this is just a limitation period for the URS or the UDRP down the road. People would still have a recourse to the courts for all the other disputes. So this is trying to go to the 80-20 rule, the Pareto rule, trying to simplify the procedure for the very clear-cut and obvious disputes, not the disputes that are 10 or 15, not disputes involving domains that have been registered for 15 or 20 years that are more complicated and are really unsuited for a procedure that doesn't have the due process of the courts, where there's no discovery, no cross-examinations, et cetera. So hope that addresses the concerns, and we can go on to the next proposal.
Great. Thank you, George. This is Kathy. Hold on deck, please, as you are the next proponent of proposal number 7 coming up. And I just wanted to encourage people to talk with George. It sounds like he's receptive to changing time periods and other features and other research. So as other people are talking on other proposals in the background, please feel free to approach him on this one. We are now up to the next proposal number 7, which is a draft policy recommendation. And George, this is yours as well. You're open for 5 minutes.
George Rickles again for the transcript. Yeah, I just echo Kathy's concerns. Happy to take questions on all these proposals on the mailing list or after this call, even, by phone if people want to discuss. This is a very simple proposal. I can summarize it in 4 words, which is legal contact in who is. So this proposal is to is for the ERS to be changed to require that providers provide notification to a registrant's legal contact in addition to, but not replacing, the current required notification to registrants. At the implementation stage of this policy change, who is, or its successor, RDAP, or whatever it's going to be called, would be augmented to add that legal contact on an opt-in basis. And to reduce costs, notices from the URS providers to the legal contact should be by email and fax only and not courier, so it'd be very cheap to make this implementation change. And so, for example, if I own math.com, which I do, and if Zach Muscovich is one of my lawyers, I could have Zach Muscovich in the whois as a legal contact. So a potential complainant could see that in the whois, and even before filing a URS or UDRP, they could know that I have a lawyer. They could be able to reach me to settle things before the URS or UDRP. But in the event an actual dispute is filed, the provider would just need to provide the additional notification by email or by fax to the legal contact in addition to the registrant. And so the underlying problem is that in civil litigation, the clock really starts ticking when actual notice of the complaint is achieved, by a process serving according to the rules in a local jurisdiction or by the Hague Convention if you're serving the process outside your country. And so the URS hasn't really attempted to measure actual notice, but instead starts the clock immediately upon the notice of complaint being sent, but not necessarily received by the registrant. So this proposal attempts to address this deficiency by adding a new contact, legal contact, who would supplement but not replace the existing contacts, and thereby increase the likelihood of early actual notice to registrants regarding the dispute. As we all know, there's very high default rates in these dispute resolution procedures. So this would help improve notice and perhaps reduce the number of defaults that takes place. So a registrant who is on holiday and misses a notification could go to their spam folder, et cetera, is less likely to default if their legal contact is going to receive the notice of complaint in parallel. So early notification to a legal contact also allows more time to respond without the lag that occurs waiting for a registrant to receive the notice, find a lawyer, et cetera, if they don't have a lawyer. And this would actually also reduce the incidence of frivolous complaints because potential complainants, would think that a registrant might not have legal representation, could know that, this registrant has a good lawyer, they're not going to be able to be bullied, et cetera. And where there's actually a legitimate complaint, let's say against a registrant who has hundreds of thousands of domains where one might have squeaked through, having that legal contact might actually encourage fast settlement without resorting to a URS or UDRP, which saves everybody time and money. And that's the proposal, and I'm happy to take questions.
George, thank you very much. This is Kathy. So Zach is in the queue, and I am going to add myself into the queue with the question. Zach, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Zach Muscovich. There was some difficulty in hearing me before I saw from the chat. I hope that's not the case now. Once again, I support this for inclusion in the interim report because it is deserving of further examination, study, and feedback, including by myself. This potentially, my initial review, can assist both complainants and respondents. Complainant can conceivably have recourse for sending cease and desist or for service of the URS process to a registered agent, the same way that applies to corporations and companies in many jurisdictions. From the registrant, there's a bunch of potential benefits as well in terms of ensuring that you, the registrant receives notice of process and ensuring that the world knows who your representative is for such a process. On the other hand, there are complications and issues that arise in terms of how this interacts with who is in whatever form it takes in the future, and so it needs further study, but I support its inclusion in the interim report. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Okay, I'm next in the queue, and then Susan. So first, a little bit of background on the legal contact issue. I'm taking off my co-chair's hat, and I'm putting on my who is hat, because I've done, as many people in this working group know, I've done who is work for many years. And then a question for George, which he'll answer at the very end. And, you know, obviously there is no legal contact right now in the who is. There was one recommended by the expert working group. As Maxim noted in the chat, there was controversy over that because, as he says, the expectation of a legal contact from a physical person is a bit high. So the requirement of a legal contact for everyone, just for some of us, just meant that the individual was putting their own personal data forward in a public place. But certainly there are groups that want legal contacts. So, George, I'm not sure of our ability as a working group to specify terms in the upcoming registration directory service database, the successor to the who is, but would you, you know, just question, is it possible to revise your proposal to say if a legal contact is required without getting into the mandatory or optional, because someone else is going to be looking at that question, in that case, then that legal contact, if available, should be used, So that's the question, rather than making it a requirement, which may be outside our scope, to put it in if that, that term exists. Let me hand this to Susan Payne. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yeah, it's Susan Payne. Just a really quick comment, and actually, really, Kathy, you kind of touched on it. I don't have strong feelings about this one way or the other. I can see that there might be circumstances where it's useful. Just a real, I guess, just a kind of caution that, you know, given where we are with state of who is and you know, the various work that's going on in other parts of the ICANN community, it just seems to me that this is one where, you know, we're going to struggle within the working group to be making recommendations that other parts of the community on topics that other parts of the community are working on at the moment. That's not to say that as you suggested, you know, if there becomes an appetite for this in other groups, then it seems, you know, it could be beneficial and helpful. So maybe we need to just, you know, be careful with the crafting of the proposal when it goes out for public comment to kind of make it clear that we're not trying to undermine work or anything else.
Terrific. Thank you, Susan. We still have more time on this issue if anyone does want to talk, and I will take my hand down. Going once.
It's Claudio, Kathy.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, just to add some more color to the discussion. You know, I think the way the ICANN community functions, there are often cases where working groups will provide recommendations. One that recently came to mind was the Consumer Trust Review Team. You know, they had developed some thoughts and some recommendations on rights protection mechanism issues, and staff recently circulated those around. You know, so I think what Susan mentioned and I think what you touched on, Kathy, are fair points, but just wanted to note that, you know, I don't think it necessarily makes it outside of scope. I think if we're looking at an issue and we have recommendations on it that they then go basically into the ether in terms of you know, the ICANN community, and they'll be there for future reference for either current groups or future groups. Thank you.
Terrific, Claudia. Thank you. Anyone else on audio? Then, George, we return it back to you for the four-minute wrap-up. Thank you.
Again, thanks for the thoughtful comments, everyone. Yeah, just to be clear, this is proposing that the legal contact be totally opt-in. So somebody that really wants to be reached when they're on vacation or is paranoid about missing a notification could have an extra field in the who is, which lists their lawyer. You know, this could probably also apply to various large corporations who don't want to miss a notification or want to make sure that the notification goes to the correct place, because you know, the admin contact might not necessarily be the same as the legal department in some large organizations. So this isn't meant to, you know, force anybody to have a legal contact that doesn't want it. It just allows people improved notification. Like, conceivably, we could have had, you know, people put in their Twitter account or Facebook account or other notification methods. You know, we have fax as one of the mechanisms right now. You know, this is just another means of notification, another contact person. So hopefully it's not too controversial to mandate, not necessarily mandate, but permit registrars who want to offer that as a potential whois element to, you know, have that in their whois. And the only compulsion would be upon the providers to actually make the notification in the event of a complaint. And the way I've proposed it, it's the cheapest methods, you know, fax and email, so they wouldn't have to courier it for, you know, the extra $20 or $30 that the courier cost would cost. And this is actually a potential revenue opportunity for lawyers, most of which you are. So if you have clients, you could, you know, offer the service of being the whois, the designated whois contact for legal disputes. So some of you might see this as a revenue opportunity, make a few extra bucks a year to have to be the contact that receives the complaint in parallel to the admin contact, et cetera. So hopefully, you know, this is a friendly proposal, and implementing it wouldn't be technically hard because it's just an extra contact field. So I guess we can move on to the next proposal. Sorry, I'm not necessarily following all the chat comments, but I'm going to review the chat afterwards and perhaps respond in writing. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, George. Thank you, everyone, for an interesting, useful, and kind of valuable discussion on number 7, fleshing out both kind of existing questions, past questions that have been raised. Very interesting. So number 7 is finished. We now move on to proposal number 8, which is, again, George's proposal. I just want to remind everybody that George moved a number of proposals from phase 2 to phase 1, which is why they're kind of coming all in a sequence now. George, number 8, please go ahead for 5 minutes.
George Krikos again for the transcript. So this is proposal number 8, which can be summarized in 4 words as, you know, the duration of the response period. And so right now there's a one-size-fits-all response period of 14 days in the URS and is 20 days in the EDRP. This is only for the URS, given we're in phase 1. And so the proposal is that the response time be adjusted by adding 3 additional days for every year that has elapsed since the creation date of the domain in dispute, up to a maximum of 60 days in total. And so the rationale is that deadlines in civil litigation are typically measured from the time of the actual notice of the complaint, the actual notice, being served by the Rules of Civil Procedure, the Hague Convention. But the ICANN develop policies don't even attempt to measure actual notice, but they start the clock immediately. And so we have a problem with high default rates and people not responding. But however, there's less urgency to a dispute when it's involving an older domain name. So this policy proposes to take this into account by giving an extra 3 days for every year that the domain is registered. So if a trademark holder wants to take 5 years, for example, to bring a complaint, this would be balanced out by having an extra 15 days to respond for the registrant over the current period. And so this proposal reduces the burdens on respondents of complaints not being brought in a timely manner by adjusting that time period. And if there's actual urgency, there's always the recourse to the courts at the option of the trademark holder. but if it's not an urgent complaint, given that, you know, it's taken years to bring, then this counterbalances that by giving the registrant more time to respond. So I guess there's not much more to say beyond that, so I'll leave it open to comments.
Thank you, George. And this is Kathy, again, not with my co-chair's hat on, but echoing what Christine is saying in the chat, that this is a creative idea. And all the years I've been discussing UDRP and URS, I don't remember anyone talking about this. So a creative and interesting idea. Who would like to speak to her? Renee, good. Please join us for 2 minutes, please.
Hi, thank you, Renee Fossum, for the record. I guess my concern or statement would be that I don't know what this proposal does that doesn't already exist in the URS. There's 6 months to a year that registrants aren't using, that they have additional time to respond. Now, this isn't in connection with UDRP, but we're not really talking about that right now. And the working group did extensively look at the stays and extensions that were granted in these cases. Also, which is another way to address the concerns for time to consult with attorneys and advisors. So I guess I don't really understand how the 3 days would necessarily equate to anything more than what they already have the opportunity to do within the first 6 months to a year. And also, the issue with actual notice, if a respondent hasn't checked the email already and the fax and mail, I don't know how the longer you drag it out that notice is going to be achieved with the equation of 3 more days for each year. Those are just my concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Renee. Appreciate the input. Would anyone on audio like to speak? And anyone else in, I'm not going to summarize the chat, although staff has promised to look at all of these chats as they're preparing the initial report. Anyone else? It looks like it's back to you, George, for a 4-minute wrap-up. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris, again, for the transcript. To address Christine's point, or, sorry, was it Renee or Christine, whoever spoke before me, even though there are abilities to appeal within the URS mechanism, the fact remains, though, that after 14 days, the dispute would be in default, and the panelists would make a decision not hearing from both sides. And so you would have a scenario where, you know, person went on a 3-week vacation, finds their domain name suspended, not having made a complaint. So the actual damage would be done because there would be a suspension. And so this especially is a concern for domains that have been registered for a long time, that, you know, you're not really expecting these complaints. So having that additional time period would reduce the incidence of default and also suspensions, where, you know, most of the cases that are in default end up as suspensions, like it was like above 90%. So that's an important counterbalance. This is kind of an alternative to having the statute of limitations. It's not as harsh upon trademark holders, instead of killing their ability to bring the dispute entirely within the URS, it would at least give the respondents or the registrants more time to respond, which is perhaps an equitable trade-off. I noticed Susan has her hand up, so maybe
you can retain your time. Good. 2.5 minutes left. Susan, go ahead, please.
Sorry, I put my hand up and I was too late, so George was already speaking. I do have a lot of concerns with this. I know that George says this is an alternative to a limitation period, but I mean, it's effectively a limitation period, because there's a pretty, you know, we're talking about the URS here, pretty short time period for responding to a URS. And you don't have to add too many 3 days before you've created a de facto pointless exercise, because it no longer is a URS. You know, it's meant to be rapid. I think the reality is, to me, it seems like, you know, if a domain has been sitting there being used for many years, it's highly unlikely that someone would use the URS anyway. But even just based on what we currently have before us, in terms of the research that we did within the sub-teams, there was, there was really no evidence that there was a problem with people missing the notices, with you know, multiple numbers of people going down the kind of de novo review or appeal route, saying, I wasn't aware, I wasn't informed, now I'm back from my holiday. And I know we've only had this running for a little time, but we haven't seen any evidence in the work that we've been doing for months now that there is a problem here to be fixed. And it very, very quickly, my real concern is very quickly this takes the R out of the URS.
Thank you, Susan. Appreciate your raising those concerns and the context for them. George, we go back to about 2.5 minutes for you.
Yeah, George Rickles again for the transcript. Yeah, Susan kind of hinted at my response by saying that, well, after 2 or 3 years, you're not necessarily going to bring the complaint. So the idea that the procedure is meant to be rapid, that seems to only happen at the whim of the trademark holder at the present time. So they can be rapid. They could expect a rapid procedure after taking 5 or 10 years to bring the complaint. So it seems as though the word rapid doesn't mean any rapidity in terms of them bringing the complaint. So this is kind of a small penalty for them taking their time to bring a complaint. 3 extra days for every year that they've waited does not seem to me to be an atrocious a penalty for having waited, you know, years and years to bring the complaint, because there's simply less urgency. And as for the evidence, we do, in a sense, have some evidence. The fact that there's such a huge default rate in the first place, the registrants were never contacted. Like, the only people that we've contacted for research is the providers and the trademark holders. Like, the important stakeholder is the registrants, and the registrants haven't been contacted for research in this PDP. And so that's, you know, a big issue, and we'll probably see that in the coming period, especially if this initial report is widely publicized, so that, you know, registrants can see, you know, some of the problems that they've experienced, at least with the UDRP, because not too many would have had a URS yet. But, you know, many of them probably aren't aware that if the URS is expanded to legacy TLDs, you know, they would have to be able to respond within, you know, a very short time period. And, you know, in that time period, you know, understand the complaint, understand the procedure, possibly retain a lawyer. That's a lot to expect from a layperson, let alone a professional who, you know, might be on vacation, might be at a WIPO conference for 10 days. Thank you.
Thank you, George, and thank you, Greg. And thank you, everyone. Appreciate the substantive discussion on proposal number 8. We're going to give George's voice a rest now, and staff is going to present Marie Petula's number 13 proposal. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you very much, Kathy. This is Julie Hedlund from staff, and we'll note staff will just be reading out of the proposal, which you see here in the Adobe Connect pod. And it is unsynced for you to follow. And then what staff will do is collect from the chat room and the transcript the various comments in the discussion about the proposal, and we'll convey those to Marie, and she will respond on the list. So just to then move down here, the recommendation, what is the URS recommendation you're proposing, that the losing respondent cannot re-register the same domain name once it is no longer suspended. The rationale for the proposal is where a respondent loses the URS case relating to a specific string, it should not be permitted to simply re-register that name once it is no longer suspended. This would help to prevent gaming of the system and unnecessary cluttering of the provider's workload with spurious or vexatious cases. The evidence is from the super consolidated URS topics table and the practitioner's subteam, section F2. In some cases, losing a respondent is able to re-register a domain once it becomes available. And after the lock, the cyber squatters just renew the domain name. Where has this issue been addressed? Also from the super consolidated URS table, section F2 in the practitioner sum team, That's actually the same comment as the response to Q5. Question 7, does the data collected and reviewed by the subteam show a need to address this issue and develop recommendations accordingly? The practitioner subteam considered the issue and put the but the recommendation goes only to a technical operational rather than this policy fix. However, the document subteam's draft policy recommendation is that the question of adequacy and scope of remedies be deliberated among the full working group. And then for a response to question 8, she says, see above. So that is the proposal, and I will turn it back over to you, Kathy. Thank you.
Thank you, Joyce. Thank you for walking us through that. George, then Michael. George, go ahead, please.
Yeah,
I thought you were going to rest your voice. Never mind.
Yeah, George Grikos for the transcript. Yeah, I'm not unopposed to this proposal. I think it has good intentions. However, I think it'll be problematic to implement because, like some of the other proposals, there's no registrant verification taking place. So technically, it would be nearly impossible for a registrar to handle it on their own, let alone industry-wide, having all registrars potentially block one registrant from registering the relevant domain name at the other registrar. So I'm not sure how technically feasible this is going to be, and perhaps it'll come out in the public comment period, but it's too bad that Marie isn't here to respond and give her ideas on how she intended to overcome those technical problems. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Michael, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks, Michael Karnakos, for the record. Yeah, I think it's a shame that Marie isn't here because I'd be very interested in digging a little more deeply into the evidence that's presented and whether there's evidence this is necessary. You know, the proposal mentions that a losing is able to re-register a domain name once it becomes available, but, you know, is it happening? Does it happen often? Can they point to a single specific instance where it has happened? I'd be super interested to know that. You know, and because it seems to me that if you have a spammer who loses one misspelling of Mercedes or one misspelling of Adidas, rather than waiting for the suspension period to elapse and then re-registering it, they're far more likely to just turn around and register a different misspelling. You know, I was at a conference of people designing anti-spyware or anti-spam software. They said they found 10,000 different ways that people have found to spell Viagra. You know, in terms of the value of this, I'm a little skeptical and would love to hear more as to whether this is a actual common practice of people re-registering domains that have been suspended. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, Zach, and then Michael. Is there anyone in the queue from audio?
Claudio.
Okay. So Zach, Michael, Claudio. Zach, go ahead, please.
Zach Muscovich. In my view, this proposal has sufficient merit to be further considered in the interim report. I contrast this proposal with an earlier related one that proposed to give a complainant a right of first refusal over an expired name following suspension. And this strikes me as a more moderate proposal in comparison to that and is therefore worthy of further consideration. I'm not sure how it could be implemented from a technical standpoint. I'd leave that to others in the feedback period and or during the implementation.
Thank you, Zach. I wish we had Barry on the phone. I'm just going to pause a second to see if Barry Cobb is with us because I think there is some factual information about this. If I recall correctly, and anyone can correct me, only one registrant has re-registered in the data that we had of all the cases in URS. But let's make a point to ask Barry about that and go on to Michael, then Claudio, and then Christine. Michael.
Yeah, Michael Graham for the record. I agree with Zach's comments. I think this is worth going forward. I think there are implementation issues, but I don't think those are for us to consider at this time. The fact that there may have been only one instance that we can document at this time of a losing registrant coming back and re-registering after the suspension period is not a reason not to impose this. certainly there are workarounds for respondents registering under a different name and such. But I think this is a reasonable limitation going forward. And to be specific with Zach's comments, this seems to be a fairly benign rule that acknowledges the fact that it was brought in a situation where there was clear and convincing evidence of misuse or abuse, and does not necessarily put the trademark owner who may have brought the action first in line, but prevents the wrongdoer from registering again. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. Claudio, I think you're next.
Thank you. Thanks to Maria for putting this together. I think it's a creative proposal. And I agree with the comments about the potential implementation challenges. I think generally speaking, we need to distinguish implementation challenges from policy challenges or substantive challenges, because I think a good number of the proposals have implementation challenges, and putting it out for comment is a way to get more information from the contracted parties and other players in the ecosystem who could address those issues. The other point I wanted to mention was regarding the fact that the domain, I've worked with clients who have brought URS cases, and the registrant has lost the case. And unlike this proposal, they haven't re-registered the name, but they've renewed the domain name. And so you create a scenario where it creates a tremendous cost of monitoring burden on the trademark owner, because they effectively have to monitor the domain for the rest of its life cycle to see what can happen. And so even if we haven't seen many of these domains re-registered, the fact that they can be re-registered creates that scenario where the trademark owner has to continue to monitor their domain once it reaches the expiration date. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Claudio. Christine and Maxim. Christine, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. This is Christine Doreen, Amazon Registry Services 52 Top Level Domain Registry. This is a practical impossibility, and I strongly oppose putting out any proposals for public comment that are unicorns. I think that you can dangle something, because we all agree to be a problem, but I think that you can't dangle something in front of the public, like, wouldn't this be a great idea, when it's absolutely impossible to implement. I mean, we're not just talking about some implementation concerns. We are talking about you cannot, at this point, distinguish between registrants, even necessarily within a registry or registrar, assuming they create a whole new account with a whole new persona. And there's evidence that there are cyber squatters that have thousands of accounts. And so they account hop from place to place to place. And then, they can account hop even between registrars. So I think that, and then George actually pointed out in the chat, that if someone is actually, puts fraudulent who is information in, like Google or Amazon, now that prevents those people from being able to register the domain name. So I'm being very generous in my inclusion, and I think that most of these proposals, whether I agree with them or not, should be put out for public comment. And this is the first time so far that I've raised my hand to express a strong disagreement. I do not believe we should be putting unicorns out there for people to make as a wish list when they are not practically implementable. Thank you.
That was a strong statement. Thank you, Christine. Maxim, over to you.
Maxim Alzoba, for transcription purposes. There are two issues with this proposal. First, there are no safeguards against situation where trademark is not protected anymore. As I mentioned in the chat, it would create gaming opportunity for trademark owners, like have protection for 1 year, ask your affiliate to register it, file a US case against them, win, and have for protection forever. It seems to be unbalanced. And talking about registrars, the thing is, there are almost no way to identify a person behind something. If we are talking not about like law-abiding citizens and companies, but about bad guys, sometimes you cannot understand what person is behind the like internet. If you're providing the service of registration of domains, it could be a good guy, but lately his passwords could be stolen and used for some bad things. So registrars, especially after implementation of GDPR, they cannot share information with third parties if it's outside of the law. For example, law enforcement can ask about the details if it's in borders of law, but not necessarily other registrars or QRS providers, because it's a bit of limit, I'd say. Maybe we could discuss it to understand if something limited could be implemented, like limitation of the registration of this name for like 1 year if it's still in TeamCH and it's still in trademark database. Thanks.
Thank you, Maxim. So, Julie, I'll pause just to see if you want to come back on to respond, which I don't think you do, but I thought I'd pause.
Thanks, Kathy. I feel I am unable to impersonate Marie at this time, but I can tell you that staff will capture from the transcript and the chat and provide that to Marie to respond.
Terrific. And I hope some members of the working group, particularly those, maybe Christine, maybe you can reach out to Marie and let her know, and others, and let her know what some of the thoughts were here and some of and some of the concerns, and maybe she has thought through some responses or can do that before Barcelona. I don't know if she's joining us in Barcelona, but that's where revised proposals will be set forth. Thank you. Thank you for the discussion of proposal number 13. We now return to George for proposal number 12. George, please.
George Rikos for the transcript. So this proposal aims to settle a longstanding ambiguity in the policy. And I think as policymakers, it's up to us to make an unambiguous policy so that we are the ones that are defining the policy and not leaving it up to the panelists to interpret those ambiguities according to their own personal biases. And so, as we know, the three-prong test of both the ERS and the UDRP, you have to show confusing similarity to a trademark, no legitimate interest, and the third prong of the test is to show that the domain name was registered in bad faith and used in bad faith. And so that part, registered in bad faith, is somewhat ambiguous because some people would want it, like myself, to be the creation date of the domain name. That's the earliest possible time period that the domain name was registered. Others, and this was the Octogen analysis, which was thoroughly discredited by panelists later on, sought to have registered mean renewal. So every time the domain name was renewed, that the domain name was considered to be re-registered, and that would keep pushing that date of registered in bad faith into the future, year by year. And what panelists have settled on over the years on their own has been to interpret that ambiguity to mean when it was most recently acquired by that registrant. So if they weren't the original creator of the domain name, the domain name gets reset, if the relevant time gets reset, as to when they as an entity acquired that domain name. And so this proposal aims to eliminate that ambiguity, to make it unambiguous that the relevant date should be the creation date and as the registration date. So you have to prove bad faith creation of the domain name, not necessarily at the time that the domain name was acquired. And so I've spoken to how that ambiguity has arisen because the policy has allowed for interpretation. And in my view that, this has been consistently wrongly interpreted by panelists over the years. And it's really a pro-complainant policy that just because you acquired a domain name from somebody else, that that new acquisition date should be the relevant time period. And we know from other intellectual property like copyrights, trademarks themselves, patents, the relevant dates don't get reset once you transfer that ownership to somebody else. There's a concept of a successor in interest, and you pass along all the attributes of that asset, including the priority date, which was the creation date, at least for registrants. And so, back when this policy was created, in the 1990s and early 2000s, this might have been an innocent mistake by panelists, but domain names themselves are considered very valuable, and it's no longer really acceptable to treat domain names as, second-class assets that are somehow inferior to long-standing trademarks, long-standing copyrights, long-standing patents. They should be allowed to be assigned to anybody and not be penalized for that transfer of ownership. And these penalties actually, having the date reset, can have a profound effect because it could affect the succession planning for a business, succession planning for, families, passing a domain name from a parent to their offspring. What happens after the death of a domain name owner? Ultimately, individuals die, even companies die, they get reorganized. And so having that date reset just because the domain name was transferred, I think has been a very deep policy error. And it's because of that ambiguity in the policy. And so this proposal aims to reduce the risks and harms to registrants of ownership transfers, thereby protecting registrant rights just on an equal level as copyrights, patents, trademarks themselves, who retain that priority date when they're transferred. And if we look at the data, we know what the WIPO panelist views are, so I won't go over that again, but there actually was one case, which was over an adult domain name, a typo of voyeur.com, which was actually correctly decided, in my view, that the respondent was determined to have registered the domain name as of the original creation date as a successor in interest, not the acquisition date. So I think I've covered all the points I wanted to make, and hopefully even if people don't agree with the proposal, that they leave it open to public comment so that this ambiguity can be eliminated in the policy. Thank you.
Perfect timing. Perfect timing, George. We only have one person in the queue, but I get the feeling that may change. Susan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you. There's a lot of information going on, a lot of conversation going on in the chat about this, and so I don't really want to duplicate that. But I think it's important to look at that in terms of considering the difference between these types of dispute and others. I'm trying to work out where to start, really. But I'm strongly opposed to this, as you probably gather. The challenge that we have is George talks about things like trademarks, that when they get transferred, the clock doesn't reset. But the reality is we're talking there in trademark terms about very different circumstances because, there isn't that, registered and used in bad faith element in those cases. If you transfer a trademark to a new owner and they start doing something different with it, the clock on liability for infringement or whatever does reset, because there was never that reference back to the date of registration in the first place. I don't think I'm really explaining this very well, but this is, I don't believe there's any ambiguity in those rules. I think it was entirely intended, and the interpretation that has been given is entirely intended and absolutely correct. I'm going to stop because other people have got their hands up, and I suspect they're going to be much clearer than I'm being.
I thought you were very clear, Susan. It's a complicated proposal. Michael, go ahead, please. Is there anyone in the queue on audio?
Okay. I'd like to get on. This is Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca. We'll put you after Nat. Michael, go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael Karnas, for the record. Yeah, I agree with George, and I think this proposal clarifies a fundamental misapplication of the procedures that's been going on. As I pointed out in the chat, the very next provision, the URS mentions registered or acquired, so I think it's inherently problematic to be conflating those two, and clearly not in the spirit in which the language was drafted. But, you know, looking in the chat right now and on the previous discussions, I'm seeing all kinds of wargaming out as to how particular scenarios could be problematic from one side or the other, or what happens in this scenario, or what happens in that scenario. Like, at the very least, I think that this proposal illustrates a very serious issue to consider. And I think that the ambiguity there and the controversy there means it's worth going out for public comment to solicit further input. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I just want to point out the colorful language that's being used, because I appreciate it. Wargaming, unicorns, and 10,000 variations of Viagra. This is a really interesting conversation. Matt, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm going to say much what Michael just said, is that from my looking mainly from the UDRP, there's a lot of ambiguity as to what creation date really represents. For years, we didn't really know whether a transfer of ownership would be treated as a new registration by panelists. And, you know, eventually, we learned that it was going to be. And there's also, I think, some ambiguity as to whether the creation date, if a domain is deleted and then re-registered, like through a domain auction, and then you have a new registrant, would that reset the clock in a way that a transfer of ownership through a sale might not reset the clock, according to George's proposal, as I understand it. And then there's some panelists who will somehow just, you know, look back at, you know, look at the current use and will somehow look back and say, well, because of the current use, we can infer a registration in bad faith, not looking at evidence at the time of the registration. So there's all sorts of ambiguities around how to measure the right start point in terms of determining a bad faith registration. And again, whether, you know, George has exactly got it right with his proposal, it does seem like this is an area worthy of further discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It sounds like a move towards the initial report, which is a way of continuing further discussion. Interesting. It's an interesting proposal. Let's go to Rebecca and then to Maxim. Rebecca, please.
Rebecca Passionate. So I too think this is interesting, but needs further development. And I have to say, my specific experience makes me concerned with precisely the situation just described, where, you know, say a domain name expires because, you know, small businesses aren't always the greatest about keeping that up, and then is sold to someone who starts using it for infringing purposes. I actually know of a UDRP, also of an adult site, where this is exactly what happened. And I would be interested to see thinking on how one might distinguish different events rather than just sort of a blanket statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Maxim, please.
Maxim Alzup, for the record. My suggestion is I'm not sure how to use non-existing field, because currently DNS system doesn't track the history of what was with the current domain. Who registered it initially? How many times it was registered? When it was deleted, for example, in the previous cycle? The idea is that domain follows so-called domain life cycle. You can Google for the domain life cycle on ICANN site, and you will see some funny pictures saying what happens from the registration to the deletion. And that's it. It's binary. Either it exists in some form or not. And previous information is not tracked, actually, and it was tracked. Even, for example, if we add some set of fields describing the history, it will not be possible to add the what happened to the old domains. For example, some .com domains with 15 years of history. So I'm not sure how to implement it in reality. Thanks.
Thank you, Maxim. George, it's going to go back to you in just a second. I'm just going to make a note that a lot of interesting points have been raised, and you know, one question to which I'd love to hear the answer in your 4 minutes is, would you be receptive to working with some other people in the group to further refine this? 4 minutes. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, George Krikos here. I'd definitely be amenable to hearing all the public input from public comment period and people on the mailing list as well as in the chat. Just to address some of the points, I think the overriding concern is that if we try to amend this thing, is we definitely want to have safe harbors to identify legitimate transfers that shouldn't be resetting the dates. A lawful transfer from a parent to their child shouldn't have to trigger a reset or loss of rights or loss of priority of that domain name. And it doesn't happen when you assign a copyright. It doesn't happen when you assign a patent. You don't get extra time for assigning that patent to somebody else. You don't lose time for assigning that patent. Nothing changes. It's the creation date is the determining factor. And so that's how it should have been for the domain names, but it's long been interpreted in what I think has been the incorrect way. And I do take Rebecca's point seriously, that conceivably a domain name could drop through the drop cycle through an auction house and not actually be fully deleted. And so perhaps those domains need to be marked somehow separately than real, well, I'm putting real in quotes, real transfers where there's a perhaps a real assignment as opposed to a kind of a pseudo assignment to the various expiring domain names. But this issue of a priority date, is fundamental to the value of a domain name, and that asset is being diminished if you have to reset and look for all trademarks that have been created since the creation date of the domain name. If the domain name was registered in good faith, it really should have been a safe harbor in itself at that time. Furthermore, this policy proposal kind of is not required if we actually go forth with a statute of limitations, because obviously the statute of limitations would be an even more effective way of handling the problem without having to bother with transfers being reset, et cetera, because the statute of limitations would presumably be a short enough period where the cases would go to court anyhow. And just as an overriding concern, we have to remember that people can always go to court. So we're not saying that people are being hampered in some ways. They just can't use these streamlined procedures for these kinds of more complicated disputes. Those disputes are really intended for, or really should be going to the courts and not to these processes that have, no cross-examination, no discovery process, et cetera. So they really shouldn't be suited for these simple procedures that are aimed to address, the vast majority of clear-cut cases. Once you have transfers of ownership, over 10, 15 years and so on, really they appear to be unsuited for this procedure. And so there should be that better safe harbor that this proposed interpretation of the policy or clarification of the policy would achieve. Thank you.
Thank you, George. And I'm going to thank you for the presentation of the proposal as well as the response. I'm going to urge you to check the chat room that was going on while you were speaking, because there are a number of interesting ideas that were posed there while you were talking. So that may offer some alternatives, options, wording, et cetera. So terrific. That does proposal number 12. We're at the 1 hour, 20-minute mark, so I want to thank everyone for their patience today and the marathon as we run through, I think it's 8 proposals altogether, and we are down to the last 3. Proposal number 18, again, goes back to George for presentation. Go ahead.
George Krikos for the transcript. Okay. The next 3 proposals are actually attempting to solve the same underlying problem. So I'm just going to outline the underlying problem hopefully once if we get through all 3 of these today, instead of having to repeat the underlying problem before each of the proposals. So here's the underlying problem. As was discussed at length in November, when these policies were being created, there was the assumption that both sides can always go to court and have the dispute determined by the courts, regardless of the outcome of the URS or UDRP. And it turns out that assumption is incorrect. in some jurisdictions, example in the United Kingdom and perhaps also in Australia, the courts have found that there's no cause of action for a registrant to bring a case that disputes the outcome of a URS or UDRP. This has only been determined in terms of the UDRP, but presumably the same would happen for a URS if it was ever brought to court. So this needs to be handled for both policies eventually. And the yoyo.email case is the one that's been widely discussed, and David Maher wrote an article on Circle ID. And so obviously that's a huge problem. You know, on a Richter scale, this would be like a 9.9, because it would deprive registrants of that recourse to the courts, which is so important in keeping these policies accountable, because you could make the policy as one-sided in favor of respondents as you want. But as long as the registrant can go to court and get the correct outcome, that effectively acts as a check and balance upon the system. And so not having the ability for the court to determine this these disputes isn't a problem with the courts. It's a problem with the underlying assumption in the policies themselves, which kind of assumed that both sides could go to court. And the reason why this error happens is that, pretend that the URS or the UDRP didn't exist. What would happen? A trademark holder would be the complainant in a court action, and the registrant would be the defendant. So what happens, though, in the case that the trademark holder files a URS complaint or a UDRP complaint? There, the complainant is still the trademark holder, and the respondent in the URS is still the registrant. But now, let's suppose a registrant wants to challenge the outcome. So they go to court under the current system, and suddenly, instead of being the defendant, as they would be if the URS or UDRP didn't exist, now they are the complainant. So there's this role reversal, where naturally they would be the defendant and have all the defenses available to them defending a trademark lawsuit, a trademark infringement lawsuit. But now they're the complainant. And as a complainant, it's a fundamental thing that you need a cause of action to bring a complaint. And those UK courts are saying, you don't have a cause of action, case dismissed. So that's a fundamental problem, because the people who made these policies didn't consider the idea that a cause of action would exist in all the relevant jurisdictions. So how do we solve this role reversal problem? So there's three separate proposals, and I'll go through proposal number 18 first. That proposal is to actually copy another jurisdiction's method, where after the URS is decided, what would happen is that either side could simply file a notice of objection and pay a relevant fee, a small fee, ideally the same size as what it would cost to initiate a case in the court. That would prevent gaming. And once they file that notice of objection, the other side could simply, in this case the trademark holder, could file the complaint in court with a clean slate. So there'd be no effect of the URS or the UDRP complaint. So this notice of objection allows the disputes to proceed to courts with a clean slate without having the interference that's been caused by this kind of quirk of process. So obviously the trademark holder would still have a cause of action, you know, trademark infringement, cyber squatting, et cetera. The registrant would still have a defense. And so both sides would be basically in the same position they would be. And this proposed alteration of the procedure, which is through the appeal process by making this notice of objection, would completely solve the underlying problem that is kind of plaguing registrants in some jurisdictions. Thank you.
Thank you, George. This is Kathy. Without speaking to the merits of the proposal, which I don't want to do, I can confirm what George said, that when we were writing the UDRP and the URS, we did think that both the complainants and the registrants would have access to the court in the case of an appeal or a review. And we're a little surprised to find that doors were closed in certain countries. So I can confirm that. I look forward to the discussion on this very interesting proposal. Maxim, go ahead, please.
Maxim Alzuba for the transcript. The issue is we cannot simply say that United States law and UK law is a good example of that. All registrants, registries, and registrars, despite of their jurisdictions, have to follow it. Unfortunately, it might be simply illegal to fully follow the laws from another jurisdiction. So I suggest this thing to be reworked completely, because it's not a good idea to imply that some particular jurisdiction have these issues, and thus all registrants and registrars and registries around the world have to follow this new idea. I'm not sure it's universally applicable, and it will create more issues than it will resolve. Thanks.
Okay, sounds like a concern being voiced, strong concern. Does anyone else want to speak to this? Zach, go ahead, please. But first, anybody on audio want to join the queue? Okay, Zach, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Zach Muskovich. The only reason I happen to know a little bit about this area is that it was extensively debated and argued about it in the context of another working group, the RPM working group. And it's a tremendously complex area of law. There was and as Petter, who was one of the co-chairs along with Bill, will attest to, it was, sorry, Cynthia, back, hear me?
Yeah, Zach, I'm afraid if you could yell. Sorry about that.
Okay. Can you hear me any better?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Okay. So let me back up. What I was saying is that the reason I know a little bit about this is because it was extensively debated and argued and studied without actual unanimous agreement on this in another working group, the IGO-INGO RPM working group, and there was a final report that was put out from that, and there was a law professor who was retained, because this involves complex issues of conflict of law, etc. It's really hard to get one's mind around this issue just from reading these proposals. And it's something that before anyone could take a position on would have to further study and look into it, in my view, including me having gone through the part of that other IGO working group. I've got 20 seconds left. Let me wrap up by saying, in short, there's a real problem if the policies are worded so that complainants and respondents are supposed to be able to go to court for independent resolution, and courts aren't allowing it in some cases. And so the policies should be looked at from that perspective to see if anything can be done in terms of a revision to the policy that will enable the parties to avail themselves of those intended rights. Thank you.
Thanks. And Zach, if you want to take another few seconds, we know, you know, we talked in the chat room. We know you lost a little time. If there's anything you want to add.
That's okay for now, but thank you, Kathy.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment. Michael, go ahead, please. Michael, if you're speaking, we can't hear you. Michael Karanikolas. Is there anyone else who'd like to join the queue while Michael is coming online? Susan, go ahead, please, and hopefully Michael can join us.
Hi, yeah, it's Susan Payne. I mean, I'm not really sure what the point is in speaking up, since the bar for inclusion in the initial report is set so low anyway. So, you know, I imagine that we already have hit that. But, you know, we're offering or trying to create things here for yet another of these, where's the problem? You know, there is no real problem here that we've seen. This is like an outlier case. It was it's a UK case. It's an embarrassment, frankly. It was very badly, the claim was badly created and badly drawn up. I'm not convinced that they couldn't have drawn up a better claim that would give them a cause of action.
that it was all irrelevant anyway and consequently was not well argued because the brand owner succeeded on the merits in getting summary judgment. So everything about this was obiter in terms of the judgment that, that refers to this particular aspect. But it also didn't get a proper airing, both due to inadequacies of the manner in which it was claimed and the fact that it wasn't necessary to give it a proper airing because the registrant lost regardless. And I just, I really do think we're trying to create a solution to a ludicrous outlier case. Thanks.
Thank you, Susan. It's very interesting to have background on that case. Michael, go ahead, please.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Fantastic. So looking at this proposal and the next two, I'm not sure I would be in favor of those changes as they're currently written, because I think that in all three cases there's procedural challenges to implementation, but I think that all three touch on a legitimate challenge if the system was designed in a particular way with a particular protection in mind and that protection or the understanding of that protection is not actually working itself in, out in practice. I think that it would definitely be worth getting community feedback on these potential issues. Certainly, given the geographic scope that we're talking about and the fact that every different country is going to approach this differently, you know, Maxim is saying that in the chat that there's a constitutional right to appeal in Russia, but it may work differently or with different degrees of challenge that are possible in different jurisdictions. I think that it's worth going out to the community and saying, hey, here's a potential issue. What are some thoughts? So definitely, I think there are procedural challenges, but I would support it going out. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I'm going to draw a line under this unless we have any other comments. Anything on audio? Anyone on audio? Okay. Back to you for wrap-up on proposal number 18, George.
Yeah, George Grigels again for the transcript. Yeah, there were questions in the chat and among some of the speakers that there's no real problem. There actually, and it might be only one anomalous case. I don't think that's correct. I think there were at least two cases in the UK. If I didn't post them on the mailing list, I'll try to find them again and post them later. But the problem was also experienced in Australia, apparently, because this, as Zach mentioned, had come up in the IGO PDP as well. It wasn't the appropriate time to handle it in the IGO PDP, but that PDP, it was brought up in the context of immunity of IGOs, that where IGOs are complainants, they obviously give up their immunity when they bring a complaint in a court. But if the roles are reversed, like what happens here under the URS or the UDRP, where it's a registrant challenging the outcome and then becoming the complainant, then suddenly the IGO becomes a defendant and can suddenly claim immunity and assert a defense it wouldn't have had when it was the plaintiff. So trying to summarize it mathematically, if you have an underlying dispute between parties A and party B, A suing B is not the same as B suing A. There's some little quirks that can happen, and this can seem to happen in the UDRP, URS context because of that because of the effect of underlying cause of action or the immunity case for IGOs. And this actually has the benefit for IGOs. This was actually proposed in the IGO PDP too late. It was actually called option number 7, so we didn't deliberate it. But it would have actually been superior to the adopted proposal, which is actually coming up next, because this proposal has the advantage that it's very simple. Like, people don't have to go to court and actually argue whether who the complainant should be, who the plaintiff should be, and who the defendant should be, and whether that cause of action arises. This process is improved by design because either side who loses simply pays the fee and sets aside the decision, period. So that fee represents what they would have had to put up in fees had they actually brought the case before the court. So they're not gaming or anything. They're just paying the fee to set aside at the URS provider level. And then, when the matter goes to court, they would get that fee refunded and could, you know, proceed in the court as they wanted to, because, you know, they were the losing side and wanted the case to proceed to court. And so this would be actually more elegant than the next proposal, which required that both sides kind of fight it out and then have the cause of action problem be exposed and then try to seek another resolution afterwards. So this, by design, makes the trademark holder always be the complainant, makes the registrant be always the defendant. And so you have the natural roles of the parties not reversed. So they're in their natural roles at the URS stage, and they're actually at their natural roles before the courts. And this we saw in the YouTube procedure for handling DMCA complaints. There was no role reversal there either, because YouTube wouldn't decide the dispute. They would just, you know, let the parties kind of send letters back and forth and dispute what was happening, and then ultimately YouTube would raise their hands and say, you know, go to court and decide this, leave us alone. And so ICANN shouldn't be creating a policy that kind of makes assumptions in the courts. We should make the process itself more robust to avoid the problems entirely. And this proposal does that by design. It's really elegant, and it matches the procedure exactly from the British Columbia Civil Resolution Tribunal, which is a real offline court. Thank you.
Thank you, George. This is interesting, the preserving of the roles of the parties to continue to preserve a right of action is interesting. A lot of comments have been raised, a lot of questions have been raised. I hope you'll take them into account. You did say that 18, 19, and 20 overlap as different proposals to attack the same type of problem. So one of the questions I'll ask, whether you want to use it during your proposal time or not, is it an and or an or? Are you proposing all of these to be ands and have each of them included as policy, or ors, one solution, and you're kind of giving people three options? But you can address that when you'd like. We are now moving on to our second to last proposal, proposal number 19, and go ahead, George.
Yeah, George, quickly scan for the transcript. Yeah, these are or proposals, so these aren't and. These are all alternatives to one another. And I won't need much time to go over this proposal because, as before, we talked about what the underlying root cause was. And so this proposal is simply to adopt the solution that was decided in the IGO PDP, which is to find that if you go to court and the court decides that the registrant has no cause of action, then at that point, the URS decision, or the UDRP, once we get to phase two, would be set aside. It would be vitiated so that the decision is meaningless, like it's just set aside. And then the complainant, like the trademark holder, could file a case in court if need be, thereby restoring the natural roles of, as the trademark holder, as the complainant, and the registrant as the defendant. And so this is basically another way of achieving the same access to the court's solution, just in a different manner, you know, and it's a little bit less elegant than the prior proposal, which made it by design have the complainant always be the trademark holder and the defendant be the registrant. But this would, you know, force the complainant, sort of force the registrant to go to court as complainant first, and then if the court throughout the case saying there's no cause of action, then they'd have to go back to the registrar and the URS provider saying, you know, look at what happened in the courts. I couldn't get a good hearing of my case on the merits. You know, the policy has been thwarted because I couldn't do that. So because the procedure is flawed, we need to vitiate the URS decision so that the complainant can then so that both sides are back in the same position they would have been had the URS or UDRP case had not been decided. And then the trademark holder can bring the lawsuit as they would have done had the policy not existed. So different way of achieving the same solution, but an inferior to the prior proposal, but I put it out there because it was the solution that was adopted in the IGO PDP. And the only reason perhaps it survived was because the prior proposal was given too late. Thank you.
Okay, we now open to discussion, and I know we're all getting tired. It's been a long day. There's different things in the chat about consolidation and rephrasing, but on this specific proposal number 19 and this particular approach, does anybody want to say anything? There are no hands in the chat room. Anyone on audio? Zach, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Zach Muskovich. I'll just have one brief observation about this particular proposal in that from one perspective, it does address the concern among some working group members that, and they're quite correct with this concern, is that, you know, ICANN and this working group or what URS policy says cannot decide what case a court will, a national court will hear or not hear. Of course, we can't do that. But this proposal, you know, as I understand it, would nevertheless be able to affect how courts deal with subsequent court actions following the URS. So the way I would look at it is this, is that we put in pretty clear language, well, not we, but, you know, Kathy and the original drafters put pretty clear language in about the UDRP that parties are entitled to go for independent adjudication before, during, or after a UDRP decision. And Susan's quite correct that Yo-Yo case was an outlier, and it's testament to bad facts make bad law. But if we're trying to draft a policy to last for, if not the ages, a considerable period of time, and we have some indications that some courts might say that, you know what, Mr. Complainant, you're stuck with that arbitration decision that you got in URS or UDRP, or, and the same to the registrant. You're stuck with it because you had an arbitration and you have no right to go to court under our national law. This particular proposal vitiates or takes away the URS decision from consideration by the court because it's automatically vitiated, leaving the court with no decided arbitration court to point to say that it's already been decided. That's really the way I look at it. It's very complex and interesting, as I mentioned before, and the law professors in this group and outside the group have a ball with this stuff, as I saw in the IGO. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Personal note, I understand it better through your eyes. Thank you. Susan, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Lisa. I just want to make one other point, which is I think this is all supposed to address this concern that we should have that the poor registrant has had no recourse to justice because they've lost their URS case and they can't go to court. But it should also be, of course, that in the URS at least, and not in the UDRP, but in the URS, there's multiple avenues for appeal in terms that are drafted in the rules. And so the registrant does have avenues for recourse. I still think he has, you know, I think he also, if he drafts his case properly, has avenues in the court as well. But you know, to go back to the actual rules, there's recourse in the rules, giving him multiple opportunities to argue his case all over again. This is one of those looking for, you know, for a solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
Thank you, Susan. Zach, I'm going to consider that an old hand unless you tell me differently. Anybody on audio, or would anyone like to join? Okay. George, back to you, and if you want to do a quick wrap-up on 19 and take us rapidly into 20, hopefully staff will restart the clock when you leave. Just let them know when you're leaving 19 and going into 20, and we can restart the proposal clock. Go ahead, please.
I'm George Krikos again for the transcript. Yeah, just to address Susan's last point, that there's multiple appeal mechanisms in the URS, that's really not fair to say because these aren't the same due process protections that exist in a real court. A real court has discovery. A real court has cross-examinations. It's a much more protective scheme for both sides in terms of procedures that don't exist at all in the URS. It's kind of like saying, well, we have a kangaroo court, and then we have an appeal mechanism within that kangaroo court. It's still a kangaroo court from the point of view of people who are opposed to those providers. And we've seen, you know, circumstances that where, you know, there's all kinds of scandals. I don't want to go through them now. That, you know, you need the courts to correct those cases. And without that recourse in the courts, it would actually encourage the providers to become more extremist in their views. Imagine if the providers knew that their decisions couldn't be appealed. That's kind of scary because they can make these crazy decisions and have that become the final verdict. At least the courts provide that check and balance that, you know, reins in these kind of ludicrous decisions that are happening in some, you know, cases. And so we need that, you know, external check and balance, which is the courts. And I'd like to remind people that this is a mandatory policy for registrants. If this was like an opt-in policy where both sides agreed to it as an arbitration, where both sides opted in to have the URS or the UDRP be the final word, then I would say, you know, let the two parties decide that this is an arbitration, decided upon the rules of an arbitration, and, you know, live with whatever they get. But because of all the forum shopping and other flaws, we need this external balance, and that's represented by the courts. And so designing these procedures to ensure that both sides have access to the courts, and at least in this case it's the registrants who are suffering, you know, it's an important problem that, you know, people are trying to pretend doesn't exist. But, you know, Paul Keating has mentioned it in the context of Australia as well. So it's not just the UK one case. It's a bigger problem. Now I might as well go into the next proposal, which is proposal number 20. So somebody could put up the slides. This is the same underlying problem. And this solution was actually proposed by Paul McGrady, who isn't here, but he might recall that this was on the mailing list, or maybe mentioned it in chat at the time. But his proposed solution, which I'm making formally as a proposal as an alternative mechanism, is that the permitted mutual jurisdiction be expanded to always allow a lawsuit to proceed in the United States as a potential jurisdiction. Because there we know that people can bring a case and have a cause of action. So allowing parties to bring the case to the United States would be basically this third possible solution to the problem. It's kind of biased in the sense that, well, why should everybody be allowed to be forced to bring a case in the United States as that jurisdiction? You know, why not Canada or Germany or whatever? But it's a solution that was put out there. It would solve the problem, you know, not as elegantly as the first option, but I wanted to put it out there for completeness to see whether people would support that as another route to solving the problem. Thank you. I've got 10 minutes left.
You do. Thank you, George, for being so succinct and taking us so quickly into Proposal 20. Let's see, any hands up? This idea of creating mutual jurisdiction in the United States, is it even possible? But Griffin says, the U.S. lawyer, I actually take no issue with this particular proposal. Does anyone, you know, can anyone talk to this on, you know, especially U.S. lawyers, talk to this on a legal basis, whether this, how doable this is, or provide some background on this?
George here, maybe I can expand. I'm not a lawyer. But
go ahead.
George Krikos again for the transcript. Yeah, I think most of the major registry operators are located in the United States. So usually having that jurisdiction match the jurisdiction of the registry gives somebody like a nexus, or at least a connection that would allow the case to proceed in the United States. Having it part of the policy itself would be another way to kind of connect it to that jurisdiction. For the major legacy TLDs, if it's expanded to .com, .org, obviously those are all in the United States. All the donuts registries are donuts TLDs are obviously in the United States as well, at least for now, if you don't seek some tax advantage or whatever. But it might affect some of the smaller TLDs that are outside the United States, like the Chinese ones, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And, George, in the chat, people are saying that you can put it into the contract as well, and generally the terms of the contract, particularly regarding choice, if there's litigation, that courts will often honor that choice. So, interesting. Thank you. Thank you for the information. Does anyone else want to speak with us, provide background information, questions, concerns? I'll pause for a second. Anybody on audio? then we are at the end of quite a marathon day. George, it goes back to you. You've done an outstanding job of presenting a lot of proposals that you worked very hard to develop. We thank you for that. Can you go ahead and wrap up proposal number 20?
George Wirkles, I appreciate all the feedback on this, and hopefully we can solve the underlying problem. It might require, adjusting the three proposals based on the public feedback, but there is a deep underlying problem that, we need to address, because, I would rate this as a 9.9 on the Richter scale, as long as it's a mandatory policy that people can't opt out of, we need to make sure that both sides have access to the courts. Thank you.
Terrific. George, thank you very much. Thank you to everyone for such a long meeting. I think I'm going to be able to give you back about 5 minutes of your time in just a second. It's been a very, very long meeting, a real marathon session, but we did exactly what we set out to do, which means we're on time and on schedule as we prepare for Barcelona. Our next meeting will be on Friday. Let me turn it over to staff. Julie put it in. It's normal time on Friday, meaning the same time as today, also for 2 hours, but there's a good chance we won't go for 2 hours. We don't have nearly as many proposals. George, is that a new hand?
Yeah, George Krikos, for a second. Zach and I submitted our revised proposal, I think it was last week, so I think we'd be ready to present it on Friday if need be, because I think there was somebody mentioned that they'd be presented at Barcelona, but we could probably knock those up before then.
Actually, I'm glad you asked. I think there will be time to present it, and I think staff may even have it on the schedule, which is, of course, not circulated yet to the full working group, for Friday. So, yes, please consider yourself on deck for that. There may be, I think Claudia submitted a revised proposal. So, Claudia, there may be time on Friday to present that. If there are further revisions of proposals, including today, George, based on some of the chat room discussion, please submit. What we can't cover on Friday, we will cover in Barcelona, I think at the first session. Any other comments? And when we do the revised proposals, it will not be pursuant to the original rules. We don't have to give them the same amount of time, and the co-chairs will be working on kind of an expedited presentation of the revised proposals. So, but just heads up, it's going to be under slightly revised rules. Does anyone else want to share anything? Thank you so much for all your time today. George, is that an old hand or a new hand?
George, it's a new hand. I was wondering, should we necessarily be revising the proposals at this stage, or should we just be putting it up for public comment and then revising it after getting that public comment? And the other point was, I forgot what I was about to say. Should we – no, that was the point. I guess I was referring to – I'll probably remember it later.
Ideally, we'd have all the co-chairs on for that answer. It's a really good question. But with my co-chair's hat on, but without the opinions of my other co-chairs, I would say that there were a lot of really, really excellent comments, both on the phone and today, particularly in the chat room. There's a huge chat of really, really important comments. So to the extent that they can help clarify, explain, expand, or otherwise make the proposal stronger, the better we put something out for public comment, if indeed we are putting it out for public comment, the better the proposal, the better the comments are that we're going to get. So I would recommend that all proposal writers take into account what they heard and see if they can come up with a modification or a consolidation that makes it even better. So, George, I would say if you heard something that makes sense to you, take the feedback. As Griffin says, take the feedback and revise before we put them out for public comment. I think that's very good advice.
George, here again. I just remembered what I was going to ask. These public comments are going out after we review the TMCH proposals, I believe?
Yes.
I guess between then and, March or whenever these are due to be published, we'll all have time, for the 30-plus proposals that were made, to polish all the proposals and make them in a standardized format? Or
No. We are on a really tight timeline, and we're going to be going back to the TMCH. In fact, two of our meetings in Barcelona are going to be the analysis group coming back to us on TMCH questions and kicking off our next our return to the TMCH. We are absolutely hoping to put the URS to bed in Barcelona for the initial report. certainly for the framework and the proposals, we're not hoping to be working on it for the upcoming months. We do have to return to the CMCH, and that will take all of our attention. So please consider Barcelona to be really where we're closing the book. We may have to extend it a little bit, but please consider Barcelona where this discussion ends according to our timeline. But let me turn that over to Julie. Am I right about our timeline? And please let me know what you think.
Thanks, Kathy. Yes, that's correct. The timeline envisions finishing up the working group discussions on all the proposals and revisions to proposals in Barcelona, and then switching over to TMCH, Sunrise claims recommendations.
Thank you, Julie. I think that wraps up everything for today. Thank you, everyone, for 2 hours. Enjoy your Wednesday and Thursday, and we'll see you again on Friday. Take care.